All right, kids, welcome back to the show. I think we got that echo figured out. All right, thanks very much to Ian and Daryl and everybody in New Hampshire for helping out. It's the show, the Scott Horton Show. Chat room guys, keep me up to date here. Let me know if everything sounds okay and all of that. And in fact, Daryl, I will go ahead and get a conversation going with you here on Skype. That way we can talk if we need to chat any further to get the show going today. All right, so, tons of news. I got Peter Van Buren, Kathy Kelly, and Trita Parsi coming up. And, wow, so very little time to cover the news. Let me cover the news. So, Josh Rogan, old friend of the show. Josh Rogan and Eli Lake, not old friend of the show. And Rogan, you know, I gotta say, Eli Lake has, I think, deliberately published a lot of lies before, and I kind of suspect that he's actually, I think it's possible that he's a foreign intelligence agent pretending to be an American journalist, for what that's worth. Rogan, on the other hand, he's the kind of guy that I disagree with on a lot of things. He's got a pretty right-wing take on a lot of things. However, I do respect his journalism much more than Lake's. I can't think of a time where I ever saw him getting the story wrong. You know what I mean? He's got, again, a different take than I do a lot of times. But I respect Rogan's journalism. So that's a good preface for a story with Eli Lake's name on it, right? Israeli Mossad goes rogue, warns U.S. on Iran sanctions. And call it confirmation bias or call it important context for reading between the lines here. These two guys are pretty friendly to Israel and pretty close to Israeli intelligence and have a lot of sources along those lines. And all things being equal, throw a dart at a story they did on Iran negotiations and it would tend to have a hawkish take on it, I think, or would be reporting on people who have one, that kind of thing. Well, in this case, this story is just clearly, simply, based on many multiple sources, a story of the Israeli Mossad, that is their CIA, throwing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu under the bus. Oh, if only we could see it drive over him with those dually tires. Big bus. And Mossad has given a briefing to American congressmen, because that's how it works. And in this briefing, they warned against the Kirk Menendez bill and the addition of new sanctions. And here's the part where I should have already had the killer quote highlighted there for you. I think I already passed it. Anyway, point is, somebody said hand grenade is the guy's term. You'll throw a hand grenade into the talks and undermine the talks. It'll tank the negotiations. And, well, maybe I do have to keep paging down to get to the quote. I thought I must pass it. Oh, here it is. Evidence. Sorry, guys. I actually have a highlighter add-on that I never use. Evidence of the Israeli rift surfaced Wednesday when Secretary of State John Kerry said that an unnamed Israeli intelligence official had said the new sanctions bill would be like throwing a hand grenade into the process. But an initial warning from Israeli Mossad leaders was also delivered last week in Israel. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was on Capitol Hill. In Israel to a congressional delegation, including Corker, Graham, McCain, and fellow Republican John Barrasso, Democratic Senators Joe Donnelly and Tim Kaine, and Independent Angus Reid, according to lawmakers who were present and staff members who were briefed on the exchange. When Menendez, who was not on the trip, heard about the briefing, he quickly phoned the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, to seek clarification. And so then here's what's interesting about this is that two senior officials tell the U.S. and Mossad also shared its view with the administration that if legislation that imposed the trigger leading to further sanctions on Iran was signed into law, it would cause the talks to collapse. And the Israeli view shared with Corker and other senators also mirrors what the CIA has said. The assessment from the U.S. Intelligence Committee, quote, community, quote, "We've had a standing assessment on this," a senior administration official told us. "We haven't run the new Kirk Menendez bill through the process, but the point is that any bill that triggers sanctions would collapse the talks." That's what the assessment is. So now a minor point is Tamir Pardo, the head of Mossad, is walking this back slightly in the media and saying, "Yeah, I did say that, but all I want, though, was the end of negotiations, which could then be restarted under better conditions." Yeah, that's because, okay, he got in trouble for throwing the prime minister under the bus, and so he had to walk it back. And if you want to look at Ali Gharib, the torture prison that the Bush administration inherited from Saddam Hussein with the great commentator. Ali Gharib has a big thread going back and forth with the War Party about this morning and the spin on this and how it is clear that they were throwing Netanyahu under the bus and that they were warning to not pass the sanctions because they will undermine the talks. And only now are they saying, "Oh, no, we want them to undermine the sanctions." But then that's their lie. That's their excuse for why they're throwing the prime minister under the bus, is because the Israeli Mossad's position and they agree with the Israeli government's position that they would rather throw a hand grenade into the American government's talks with Iran and destroy them in the middle of these supposedly very sensitive negotiations about the crucial issue of whether Iran's peaceful, safeguarded nuclear program will remain such, and to what degree it will be verified as remaining as such. Okay, as long as you're being honest about it, thanks. That's Trita Parsi's tweet here. Mossad head lobbied Senate to create crisis in Iran talks, cause collapse, and then restart on better terms, or just collapse? And that's the spin. No, we weren't throwing Netanyahu under the bus warning not to do this. That's their excuse. That's when they're walking it back. And it kind of gives important meaning, doesn't it, to Lindsey Graham telling Netanyahu Congress will follow his lead, not, you know, "We will listen carefully and consider what you have to say," but Congress will do what the Israeli government wants. And here John Boehner, the Lindsey Graham of the House, has invited Netanyahu to speak to Congress without going through the president and normal diplomatic whatever the hell, just in order to, I don't know, demonstrate for all forever their loyalty to a foreign power before the American people or the American president when he's negotiating what they claim to be so concerned about, Iran's nuclear program and keeping it peaceful. It's absolutely amazing. But that's the position of the Republicans in Congress. And Rand Paul's position is about 1% better. Different sanctions, just as destructive. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Peter Van Buren, former State Department employee and then whistleblower, author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, writes for Tom Dispatch, and his latest book is Ghosts of Tom Joad. Welcome back. How are you doing, Peter?
Scott, it's a pleasure to be back with you, as always.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Very important article that you wrote for Tom Dispatch. We, of course, reprinted it under Tom's name here, as always, at antiwar.com. The Military-Industrial Complex in Iraq. America's open for business in Iraq. Psst, want to buy an M1 tank? So now here's the thing. Before we get into this article, I got to pick a fight with you. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I'm sure you do. But just one or two articles ago, you came out in favor of America doing things in Iraq, and in a pretty severe way, I think. Back in the Peshmerga, back in the Shiites, defeating the Islamic State, one way or the other. And I was wondering, I know you mean well, but don't you know that that can't possibly be a solution to any of the problems going on in what used to be called Iraq before America got there? Right now,
to clarify a little bit, and then perhaps try to defend myself here. I've constantly received emails and things that say, you know, you always are saying what's wrong. When are you going to say how to fix things? When are you going to offer a solution instead of just pointing out follies and mistakes? And I gave that some serious thought with the premise. And so I wrote an article that said the only thing America can do to quote unquote resolve Iraq. And I choose the word resolve. I don't say fix or win or any of those other things. It's resolve. Is to support the division of the country into three statelets, Shia, Sunni, Kurd, and to use America's influence and military power to make that work, primarily by using the American military as kind of a buffer where it needs to be so that these people will sort of focus on their statelets rather than focusing on fighting each other. The premise of that, which is saying American intervention is necessary, is really something that is coming out of the idea that the toothpaste is already out of the tube. It's unlikely that America will do the real thing, which is to just back out and realize this is nothing we should be involved in. But with the understanding that America is going to insist on doing something, what is the least bad thing we can do? And that's the answer I came up with. I want to clarify that I'm not in favor of intervention. And certainly anyone who's read most of my stuff would understand that. But I did want to challenge myself and maybe challenge some readers to answer the question of, if the people in power insist on doing something, what possibly could we do? And that was the answer I came up with. Mm-hmm. So take your best shot here.
All right. Well, I mean, it sounds like from a skeptical point of view, you're actually proposing more American troops on the ground than anything that the president has indicated so far, or even John McCain.
Well, in the context of this, what I'll call a thought experiment, sure. That's absolutely not what I believe should be done. I believe the United States should pull out and leave Iraq, sadly, as we've left it, to solve these issues, resolve these issues on its own. Again, what I was proposing was something of a thought experiment, starting from the premise that we're going to do something, and if we're going to do something, what is one thing that might bring this to enough of a conclusion that even the nutcases in Washington would agree we can leave and call this one done. Mm-hmm. But clearly, I am not knocking on John McCain's door with some advice.
Yeah, I get you. Now, here's the thing about this. Assuming the premise of them doing something, and never mind any of the moral arguments against it or any of that, but just from that kind of utilitarian view, it seems like if we just look at the history, we could see how, for example, after Sistani called for elections and the caucus system was off and it was clear it was going to be one man, one vote, Shiite majority there, the Americans still within the Shiite coalition insisted on picking basically Hakim and his buddies, his closest buddies in the Dawa party, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa party, because they dressed nicer and were a little bit more, you know, could speak on a more Republican level than a scumbag like, say, Muqtada al-Sadr or something like that. And they ended up putting in power not just the Shiite majority that may well have had to compromise if they didn't have the American Army and Marine Corps acting as their auxiliaries in a 5-year civil war there, 6-year civil war there. but they also promoted the actual most Iranian-backed of the Shiites, who then were the ones who told the Americans to get the hell out, just as well as Sadr would have told them to get the hell out, only he would have told them to get the hell out sooner, and he would have, as he indicated repeatedly, tried to negotiate a way to hold the state together and in some kind of coalition with the Sunnis. And so what happened, in other words, is America, by being there, distorted the power in the first place in favor of the Shiite majority, but also in favor of the very worst of their torturer murderers in the Badr Brigade and the Supreme Islamic Council in their takeover and creating the situation that led to the rise of the Islamic State in the first place. So just taking that as an example, it seems like the lesson is if our government is there doling out money and doling out weapons and picking and choosing winners and losers, all they're doing is further distorting the situation and creating a situation that is untenable and will lead to further blowback coming down the line, basically. Just like artificial bubble in the housing market by a bunch of money being pumped in there by the Federal Reserve leads to a very real crash. This leads to the very real violence that we're seeing right now. And the dissolution of the Iraqi state that you're saying we ought to go in and make permanent now is the one that we created with all our distortions from last time.
Two things. I mean, again, I just want to keep backing up to the idea that this was something of a thought experiment. And it's obviously flawed, but it was based on the premise of, well, you know, how can we put some kind of conclusion on this that allows us to leave? The idea, though, is that a tripartite, a tri-statelet, whatever word is most politically palatable, Iraq is something that basically exists right now. It exists in a chaotic form and needs to find its base, if you will, settle where it needs to settle. And that is what is going on, whether the United States wants it or participates in it or just steps away from it. To your larger point, though, I think you've hit on the core strategy, in quotes, of American foreign policy in the last two decades or so, which is basically by our interventions to stop some problem, we actually create that problem or create a bigger problem. If folks needed a more contemporary example, they can look at Yemen right now, today. Yemen was supposedly at one point a stable country. Then it became unstable with the rise of Al-Qaeda, which certainly we all understand was midwifed by the United States with Saudi help in the 80s. Then there was something of a coup, if you will, the United States promoted that got rid of the former leader and replaced him with his son, who was very happy to take American money. Now,
I'm sorry, I gotta stop you. Music's playing here, Peter. But when we get back, we will pick up on that Yemen example, and we'll change the subject to this current article, which is also very important too.
Absolutely.
It's Peter Van Buren, former State Department whistleblower. Now he's at TomDispatch.com. Back in a sec. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm online with Peter Van Buren, former State Department whistleblower, author of We Meant Well. And this one's at TomDispatch.com and at antiwar.com under Tom Englehart's name there. America is open for business in Iraq. But now where we left off, you're talking about Yemen and blowback. And I like to call it backdraft because blowback is the consequence, the long-term consequences of secret foreign policies so that everybody's taken by surprise. Whereas backdraft is just when our government does things right in front of everyone that are so stupid that it blows up right in their face. And so That's my own little terminology there. You can adopt it if you like, but give me credit.
No. I will. I will, Scott. And I won't give you any credit if it works for me, which is the secret to being a good writer. You know, it's almost like a physics thing. You know, I think it's called the Heisenberg principle that says as soon as you observe something, you change it. And that's kind of how American strategy, particularly in the Middle East, is working. As soon as we intervene, we screw it up. And we were talking about Yemen before the break, and here's a perfect example. So the United States installed a dictator, if you will, in Yemen that was very sympathetic to American needs and aims. And this caused a domestic organization, the Houthanis, who essentially threw him out of office yesterday or the day before and are now once again looking to Iran for support. You know, none of that would have happened if the United States had just kept their hands off of Yemen or worked with a government that had popular support trying to get its way, get them to work towards America's goals. However, governments that have popular support tend to be more interested in their own needs and keeping that popular support than just sucking up to the United States. So we install these type of puppet governments, and then we're deeply surprised when they don't work out. And you can take that bit of history all the way back into the days of the Spanish-American War, and certainly America's actions throughout Central America in the 80s. You mentioned the Iraqi examples earlier. Iran, who I almost misspoke on there, was another perfect example where the United States maintained the Shah of Iran in power so long that the Islamic Revolution was a no-brainer, and then we acted surprised. We have to stop intervening. The world is not a chessboard. America can't just insert itself, make a few moves, and expect things to work out the way we want them to. The other sides have their own needs, their own values, their own aims and goals, and their own rules. And America's desire and almost dumbfounded insistence that it doesn't work that way is what gets us caught every single time we put our foot into another big pile of it overseas. There's almost a practical side to this that stuns me, and that is, and this kind of dovetails, I think, into talking about the military-industrial complex, is the results are so blatant. I mean, for two decades at least, we'll focus just on that, the United States has done exactly the same thing, intervene militarily and manipulate politically, all over the Middle East, including Afghanistan, and it hasn't worked. Now, there's got to be a reason for someone being that willfully ignorant of reality. And I'm afraid one of those reasons, and I'll include stupidity in Washington, never can leave that one out, but one of those reasons is what I wrote about just this week, and that is the enormous profits that American companies make off of American wars.
Yeah, that is a huge part of it. On the stupidity thing, I have to chime in here just because I think it's funny. I used to, you know, when I was much younger, I used to be so concerned that all of our horrible foreign policies were all some kind of deliberate sabotage by the master planners at the Council on Foreign Relations, who know damn well what they're doing, and sort of a more of a libertarian take on that kind of John Birch conspiracy theory view of the Rockefellers and their front men and what they're up to. That it's all ultimately treason and it's all so well thought out and all that. But the perfect opposite explanation of that I can think of is this article I read in the Washington Post about Susan Rice and a few others sitting around at the State Department with kind of like a Dr. House whiteboard saying, okay, let's remake American foreign policy. Let's reexamine our Asia policy and the degree of our pivot. And what should we do about the Middle East and this and that? And I'm thinking, really, you have a meeting on the direction of the entire ship of the entire American empire, and it's Susan Rice and another room full of a few idiots on a Saturday at Foggy Bottom, and they have no idea what they're talking about. They don't speak a single one of the languages. They don't know a damn thing. They might as well be Valerie Jarrett, the political advisor. You know, Karl Rove, the political advisor, deciding everything. You know, I mean, the Libya thing is a perfect example where Robert Gates said, "Don't do it." And it was Samantha Power and Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton. I don't mean to just sound like a sexist, but I just mean these are particularly vapid people, you know, even compared to Robert Gates. You can see the idiocy in their thousand-yard stare. And just to think that this is how we come up with this stuff is, you know, it'd be a good PR stunt. Let's overthrow Gaddafi. Maybe we'll make some oil money or some little tangential kind of thing without considering what's going to come of this at all.
You know, I've always maintained it. It's kind of, we talked about physics. I mean, this is like Occam's razor. The most obvious explanation is often correct. And after 24 years at the State Department, I sat in my share of those meetings. And you're right. You're absolutely right. This is like a bunch of 12-year-olds imagining the best, coolest way to do something and acting just like 12-year-olds do. Randomly doing this and ignorantly doing that and really not knowing anything about what they're doing, but still whacking away anyway. It's hilarious when a 12-year-old does it, but it's terrifying when that, in fact, is what dominates America's foreign policy planning, such as we can use the word planning. The ignorance, the stupidity levels are frightening. You throw that in with the general butt-kissing themes of bureaucrats, particularly at the State Department. So Susan Rice mutters something about let's get rid of Gaddafi, and a bunch of smart people who absolutely know better, who are on the ground diplomats who do speak these languages, instead of clearing their throat and saying what a dumb idea and here's why, instead smile and say, well, that's what the boss wants. If I do what she wants, maybe I'll get promoted. And off we go on another adventure. The thing that lives in the background of all this is, as we were mentioning a moment ago, is the idea that all of these dumbass decisions make a lot of money for people. My article was about billions of dollars that are finding their way into American arms manufacturers for weapons going to Iraq that they don't need, they can't maintain, and which will not play any strategic role in whatever the United States imagines we're supposed to be accomplishing there vis-a-vis ISIS. Particularly, I focused on M1 tanks. This is a huge, complicated beast. It takes a long time to learn how to drive them and use the computers and shoot them, and they require near constant maintenance in order for all this stuff to work. It's a huge challenge for our own military, where we focus on these kinds of things and generally have a semi-educated workforce. It's almost impossible for a third world army, which is what the Iraqis are, to be able to use these weapons, to maintain them, to even keep them moving. The answer, of course, is that, well, they need them because we're selling them to them. And the other answer is, well, we'll also sell them then maintenance contracts. It's like when you buy, your cell phone or something, and they want to sell you the extended warranty, and they want to sell you the priority care line and the accessories and this and that. All of a sudden, the thing you bought doubles in price. People are making money off of this. If the United States did not intervene in these countries, then there really wouldn't be as much need to sell weapons. There certainly wouldn't be the infrastructure to sell these weapons. The M1 tanks, for example, that are going to Iraq are all going to be set up at a base that we built during the surge, quite conveniently. With a little bit of irony, it was the base where Chelsea Manning served and the base where I served. So it's historical in so many ways.
And didn't they mostly abandon the tanks because they're soft bottoms in an IED war, so they switched to using MRAPs finally from the aluminum Humvees and the M1s that were really vulnerable to the kind of war that they were in back then, right?
Scott, you're not thinking like an industrial capitalist here. What we have done with the Iraqis is we first of all sold them a lot of our old used junk, in some of these tanks that we didn't want to pay to ship home. And then we've sold them, quote, urban upgrade packages that are designed to address the same issues you just mentioned. See, you got to think the way these folks think. You don't say, gee, this tank is not very effective. You say it is ineffective, but here's the expensive solution to all that. If you can kind of get your head around that, all the rest of this stuff starts to fall into place.
Yep.
And it's absolutely terrifying when you realize the confluence of people who are making all this money and people who are making policy that enables it, and a military that creates the groundwork for more war. It's basically a recipe to keep everybody making money and to continue to justify a military that is far too large for and far too intervention-oriented for America's true needs.
Yeah. Well, and it really goes to the banality of evil and all that, too, where this is just how the system works, man. You got a bunch of normal people with mortgages and wives and kids who think that they're good people living good lives. And yeah, they're lobbyists for General Dynamics, and they're there to make sure that no congressman ever demilitarizes anything ever, because that's their job. And hey, if you don't like it, it's a democracy and the American people can change it, and a bunch of platitudes and bromides. But these are the interests. That's how you can tell right now that Jeb Bush is going to win, because you know he's already got all the major constituencies locked up. And it has nothing to do with town and country, black and white, liberal, conservative, or any of that. It's the arms industry and finance and agribusiness and big pharma and the insurance companies. That's how you know he's going to win, because those are the constituencies in America. And that it's also ultimately rationalized. I've heard it a million times. Hey, this is how people buy houses in America. How can you criticize? I mean, or if you do, take it up with your legislature, but leave me alone, you know?
The only thing that I'll add to that, which is even more cynical, is that Hillary Clinton, who's going to be Bush's opponent in this, is equally deep in with all of those organizations. They own both candidates. They own both parties. And so while we'll fuss and fight over, you know, the course of how many years over which one to see as president, as far as the big picture for these kind of industrial organizations and things, it doesn't really matter. Their interests are going to be covered either way. This idea you talked about at the beginning of the hour here, or the half hour, is, you know, that there's a secret hand controlling everything, and obviously that's not true, but there are organizations and people who have specific interests who exert enormous influence on how events go. They may not particularly care whether the war is in Iraq or in Yemen or in you know, the planet Mongo. What they care about is that there is a war. Mm-hmm. So that they can feed these very expensive weapons into it. And so if Jeb wants to have a war in Iran and Hillary wants to have a war in Yemen, whatever, as long as that war is on, then the interests of these organizations are satisfied and those strings are pulled.
Yep. And, you know, it's funny that, I mean, it's the ultimate irony, really, that it's Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander, who gave us this phrase, and yet it seems like, I guess, most Americans, if you just ask their mom or whatever, they've never heard of it, or if they have, it sounds maybe some nefarious conspiracy theory, and certainly not just a very simple concept about how, yeah, sure, people who have contracts with the Pentagon lobby to keep them, you know, because, and they fund think tanks to make sure that, you know, this is all very, very simple arithmetic, no calculus to it at all, you know, but it just, I guess, unless it's really beaten into their brains by way of television, it's still not really the popular understanding of the way things work, unfortunately, I don't think.
You know, the final comment that I'll share with you, and then I need to go out and make some investments in defense contractors stocks. You know, first of all, the idea of Eisenhower creating that this idea of the military-industrial complex is actually spot on. I mean, who would know better than a guy who was a career military person who became a career politician and president. I mean, he's seen it. The other idea is just of people's perhaps lack of knowledge of this thing. Tom Englehart, who edited my article, and I are both of a certain age. We're old enough that that expression is almost a cliche, the way it was used during the Vietnam War protests. And I actually said to Tom, I said, you know, should we really say military-industrial complex? I mean, isn't that sort of almost a cliche, almost a joke these days to say those words? And he and I talked about it, and we came to the conclusion that while some old folks may see it that way, unfortunately, many of our younger readers may not have encountered the term. And so we ultimately decided to go with it, and I think we're both very glad that we did, because it's a critical piece of understanding what goes on in America's world these days. And to the extent that we could pull that term forward and help readers understand that it's still very much a part of the way things work, maybe we did something useful.
All right. Thanks very much. I appreciate it, Peter.
Scott, my pleasure. I'll be back anytime. I'm sure there'll be stuff to talk about whenever we can.
Absolutely. We run pretty much all your stuff. Except that one.
Thank you.
At
Antiwar.com. Thank you.
Thanks.
Carry on.
All right. That's Peter Van Buren, y'all. We'll be right back in just a sec.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is the heroic Kathy Kelly, great American peace activist from Voices in the Wilderness. Usually whenever I talk to you, you're in Afghanistan trying to get food and books to hungry and illiterate people. Kathy, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Scott. Well, I'm good. I'm sorry actually not to be in Afghanistan, where really my main role is either to do the dishes or listen, really do a lot of listening. But I'm in Chicago because it seems that tomorrow I'll be in a prison, and I'm awaiting word from the Bureau of Prisons about what prison I should go to. But anyway, I've been sentenced to 3 months in prison for carrying a loaf of bread across a line at the White Men Air Force Base, where they are bombing Afghanistan and doing a great deal of surveillance using drone warfare.
Okay, well, first of all, where is that base? And second of all, why a loaf of bread?
Well, White Men Air Force Base is in Knob Noster, Missouri. It's a huge base, and they are now operating drones. One squadron at the base operates both weaponized and surveillance drones over Afghanistan. And it's very traditional in Afghanistan to have every meal with a loaf of bread and people sitting on the floor in a circle and a chance to talk after the meal. Mm. So I thought, well, why not bring a loaf of bread and a letter to the base and try to talk to the commander? I've come from Afghanistan. I have a constitutionally protected right to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. My young friends in Afghanistan have no chance whatsoever to talk with the commander. So I thought maybe I should try to do that, along with my friend Georgia Walker and others in the Kansas City, Jeff City area peace movement.
Mm-hmm. Did you already say you've been sentenced to do 3 months in the federal penitentiary? Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Wow. And, I read an interview, we're posting it on the blog there, I think, at antiwar.com, your interview that Medea Benjamin did, and she, you answer to her, you've been to jail more times than you can count, is that right?
Well, that's true. I mean, a lot of overnights or county jails across the country for what I think is this constitutionally protected First Amendment right to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. But also, if we had the necessity defense in this country, if you could say you acted in order to prevent a greater harm, mm-hmm. such as massive slaughter enacted through warfare, then I would have many, many less experiences in county jails.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I mean, what I'm saying is that We can't bring the necessity defense normally into a U.S. court. The magistrates and the prosecutors will just reduce things down to did you or didn't you cross that line without any question about why ever in the world a group of people who often are, you know, some of the most active in terms of community service in the entire community feel that they have to serve the cause of justice and stop the United States war making. And so they go right through the military places or the weapon making places and or legislative places and do cross lines. Yeah.
And now, was this the case where I know there was one recently where the judge actually surprisingly let quite a bit of the necessity defense into the trial?
Well, we were amazed. Way back in 2009, a number of us went to Creech Air Force Base, where there will be now a national mobilization March 4th through 6th, and that's in Las Vegas, Nevada. The judge let Bill Quigley, Ramsey Clark, and Colonel Ann Wright testify, and at the end of the trial, I mean, this judge had done 25 years on the bench hearing a lot of traffic ticket cases, and he was fascinated by this day in court, and he listened to Brian Terrell's sum up, you know, the classic, if the house is on fire and the baby is trapped inside and you go in and you save the baby, should you be arrested for breaking and entering? And the judge said, I need to think about this for 4 months. Now, truthfully, he found us guilty after 4 months, but he sentenced us to time served. Mm. It's a discussion that is happening, but I think one of the reasons it's happening is because people like Medea Benjamin and Brian Terrell and many activists with Voices for Creative Nonviolence and up in Syracuse where there are steady actions and trials and out at Creech Air Force Base, Beale Air Force Base, Whiteman Air Force Base, people are raising the issue and saying we want to put the brakes on and discuss the proliferation of drone warfare.
Yeah, and I got the name of your organization wrong at the beginning, too. I'm sorry about
well,
that.
Well, it used to be Voices in the Wilderness. We changed our name. Sadly, we didn't end the economic sanctions against Iraq, but I was glad to see on antiwar.com's website today the highlighted article by Mr. Hornberger, which includes mention of the economic sanctions against Iraq and the many ways that the United States bullied and waged warfare against people in Iraq, and that has to be taken into consideration as we look at Iraq today.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, real quick, because we're almost out, well, I guess we got 4 minutes or so. Tell us, what's it like to be an Afghan living under drones?
Well, my young friends, first of all, cannot go back and visit their families in many cases. They might be targeted, they might be tracked, and their families say, no, don't come, it's not safe. On the other hand, 70% of Afghanistan, according to some very credible sources doing on-the-ground medical care work there, like the Network of Emergency Hospitals Workers, 70% of the country is under the control of Taliban warlords, of drug warlords, of corrupt officials. So what good is all this surveillance and all of the targeted assassinations accomplished? After all these years, Afghanistan is back where it was in 2001, under control of armed and corrupt and undereducated people. So does the intelligence we need happen? It's very hard to figure out how many children in that country are starving, how many families can't feed their children or give them clean water, how many places are so subject to squalid, sprawling refugee camps that it becomes a health care disaster. How many women tried to immolate themselves this year? There were 400 attempts at immolation in Afghanistan last year. These are the kinds of things we need to understand. We need to become literate in these realities. Otherwise, we're flying blind, bumbling around, spending this year $58.6 billion on the military in Afghanistan for the war that the president just told us is over. How many mercenaries, armed military contractors are there in Afghanistan? We don't know. And then when we look at the history, I mean, Leon Panetta had said back in 2011, I believe, when he was asked how many al-Qaeda figures are there in Afghanistan, he said, oh, about 55. So we lack information, and that's deplorable. And what other countries are ever going to want to work with us when we're considered one of the most menacing, frightening countries in the world? And I can tell you, people in Afghanistan feel frightened and terrified. Who is the terrorist? That's a really important question.
Yeah. Now, this sounds maybe crass and a very narrow point, but I'm just curious, and I wonder if you know. To the regular peasants on the ground being bombed by the empire over there, does it make a difference to them that the drones don't even have pilots in them? That in the off chance that the thing crashed, that there's not even a human in there at any risk whatsoever flying around killing them? Or it's the same difference if it was a F-16 or a guy with a machine gun?
Well, they don't hesitate to use the word cowardice, but I think that the difference is also that when it's flying around, when the robot is flying overhead, it's in conjunction with the likelihood that a night raid, peopled by some very frightening, horrifically armed people, might burst into their homes. If the drone is flying around, it could mean that the Taliban are going to say, hey, somebody in your village must be in touch with intelligence from some other country, and the Taliban will come in, frightfully armed, and kill them. So people see that drone, they don't wait to ask or debate, you know, philosophically, is that an act of cowardice? They pick up their belongings and run. And that's why the refugee camps are so overcrowded. The cold weather is coming. People don't have anything to protect their children from freezing to death. So it's all very, very personal and peppered with tremendous fears. The idea that somebody's watching all of this, I mean, all the time, 24/7, there's this big, huge blimp that everybody can see from every point in Kabul up in the sky, taking pictures of all of Kabul. But how many people in the United States know about the refugee camps? Sprawling, horrid, squalid camps. People don't have water. They don't have fuel. People freeze to death. The children are out being the only income earners. The income workers are the children. And people in the United States don't know that. What kind of intelligence is the United States being supplied? American sniper. What a hideous thought.
Well, you know,
this bill
the real tragedy is, Kathy, is that if they really gave you the access on, say, you know, cable TV to explain how bad it is, they would simply spin that as a reason why we have to reinvade, because the job just isn't done yet. There's still bad guys left to kill and make everything that much worse. And
well,
they're actually,
thank you, Scott.
It's just like with Libya. If they really told the story of how bad Libya was right now, we'd have an invasion. Instead, they're ignoring it and letting it go to hell on its own, which is better than us helping send it there and make it worse. You know what I mean?
Well, the tendency to use people's heartstrings in terms of humanitarian concern as a reason to justify our invasions is something that's been invoked by people who know much, much better than to do that. And the crass reasons for people to do that really should be examined in every university across the United States that cooperates with the State Department and goes along with this reason to protect kind of argument. So the education is a crucial, crucial lever, and I'm hoping that over the months to come, as it seems as though President Obama is going to at least begin to give the nod to some more reasonable argumentation and practices, even though it'll be very hard for him to accomplish anything, I'm hoping that every group that can exercise their momentum will begin to lean hard and heavy on combining the peace movement and the environmental movement working together to say we cannot afford the wars any longer.
Hmm. Well, I actually disagree with that part. I think the anti-war movement needs to be as broad-based as possible and exclude any other issue, because there's so many different hot buttons for people to refuse to cooperate with each other on. But there's potential for a very broad-based coalition against empire if we reach out to the right on the costs to them, you know, that kind
of
thing.
I do think that one of the great problems in terms of our environment is that the military takes all the researchers, takes the funding, takes the ingenuity, and commandeers that into military concerns,
absolutely.
And there's nothing left over to
and then
deal
they're
with
the worst
very
polluters
real
terror on Earth,
we face,
too.
Which is what we're doing to our environment.
Yeah, and they're the worst polluters on Earth, the American Pentagon. And for me, that's argument why all environmentalists ought to put, you know, anti-militarism first, because there ain't nothing worse than polluting a country with depleted uranium. And nobody can compare the amount of oil they burn or you know, that kind of thing.
Anyway. And the ordnance that's littered all over places like Afghanistan will also start to litter the ranches and a lot of the pristine, beautiful areas in this country. We're so lucky right now to have as our house guests two people from South Korea, from Jeju Island, where people have every single day combined their desire to protect their beautiful island with a desire to eject the militarists who are building bases and have wrecked their coastline by creating berths where U.S. military ships outfitted with nuclear weapons would be able to dock. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot maybe that we can find inspiration from people in other countries. And I can tell you, going off to federal prison, that I know I'll find plenty of inspiration from the women locked up in prisons who find the courage to face these hideous long sentences and still keep their wits about them. By long sentences, I mean some over 10 and 15 years because of mandatory minimum sentencing and because of the ways in which judges have been tolerant of plea bargaining being used against women and men prisoners in this country.
Well, I sure hope that we can talk about that when you get out. That is a whole other conversation. I know you have a lot to say about it, but I also know that you got to go in preparation for your coming next interview here.
All right.
Good luck to you, Kathy. I admire you very much. You're a very brave lady.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Talking mostly about going to the war zones, but going to federal prison, too, that's no joke. And you do this, put yourself in these situations quite deliberately in order, you know, because you care about other people so much. And so I admire you a lot, and I wish you the very best of luck and all that.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Kathy Kelly. She's at Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And I guess we'll talk with her about how it went when she gets out. All right, well, so geez, I'm already back on, right? All right, good. All the way through the break there. I know that sounds bad for the live audience, you guys, when the commercial interrupts the interview, and then you come, especially when you come back from the break, and then the interview is still going on in the middle of a thing there, and here I am stuttering and stumbling around and can't talk right. What a disaster. It's the substance that counts. In fact, here comes a lie. I deliberately stumble and stutter around and make the broadcast quality as poor as I can just to make you value the substance that much more. Do you believe that? You shouldn't. I really try my best. My best is oftentimes not good enough, that's all. Oh, well. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. Coming up here in a few, Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. And, well, I think mostly I'm going to let him talk about the sanctions and the Congress and whatever, but I hope to also maybe fight with him a little bit about something he wrote about Iraq, too. That might be fun. Anyway, I'm very interested in seeing this nuclear deal done, only just because I'm so tired of explaining the truth about Iran's nuclear program to everybody all the time. What a giant, retarded, fake scandal. And I guess I still will, because it's not like the Israelis and their sock puppets in D.C. are ever going to give it up, deal or not. But hey, the program is already safeguarded. This entire negotiation is just to make sure that it's extra double safeguarded. Yeah, well, so big deal. Go ahead, sign the thing, I guess. So that's important. And we'll cover that in a minute. Now, Barrett Brown, friend of the show. He may be sentenced to federal prison. In fact, I need to hit refresh on some things here, man. I don't know what's the last thing that happened with him. He has given his allocution, now a 30-minute recess, prior to handing down of his sentence. Appears he'll be hit with the full 8.5 years. Oh! That's Douglas Lucas. Oh, you know what? 30-minute recess? Damn. I wonder if I could queue up a couple of sound bites for you here and try to call this guy. Let me see here. What is it? Oh, yeah, Douglas. I don't know. It may be too late to get this interview done. Actually, he had his number here earlier. The point is that Barrett Brown is being prosecuted for journalism, and he doesn't get quite the coverage that James Risen got, but he's a great American reporter, and he's being persecuted right now in federal court. And hang on, I'm going to play a couple of ridiculous Bush clips here while I try to get the guy on the show, because that's what I could think of. Whoops. I didn't realize the Beasties were playing. Sorry.
During these last few months, I've been trained by Al-Qaeda, and I'm weak and materialistic. I told our country and I told the world, if it feels good, do it. I hope you'll join me in expressing fear and selfishness. We will embrace tyranny and death as a cause and a creed. We can be summed up in one word: evil.
Okay, cool. Just 3 minutes left in this segment. That'd be just enough time to get an update on the Barrett Brown case with Douglas Lucas, journalist on the scene there. Hey, Douglas, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm fine. The government has claimed that, the prosecutor Heath has claimed, quote, the government did not prosecute Mr. Brown for political purposes. The judge has stated, quote, what took place is not going to chill any First Amendment expression by any journalist, and this is all absolutely fucking insane. Let's see here. I don't even know where to begin with this shit, other than to
wait,
say...
Wait. Yeah, careful with those. If you can. Skip the...
The obscenities?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, though.
Okay. The prosecution is convinced that and has stated that Brown has been trafficking in stolen data. Heath actually said, the prosecutor said, quote, you can traffic in things that have been public or available to other people. Whereas the defense has argued, quote, you cannot traffic something that's already in the public domain. He didn't traffic in any credit. In the credit card information, he posted a link. And so what's going on here is that basically, you know, the government doesn't like people linking to information that they don't want people to know. And it's when, you know, Brown told me he did not know what was in the file that the link led to. And sure, you know, credit card data is problematic. You know, you don't want that widespread and everything. But this is really about control over the internet and its ability to further our knowledge and link us to all sorts of information. There was a question in the court about, you know, what the defense attorney Swift brought up, what's going to happen when a reporter wants to link to thousands of pages of documents. Does he have to know every single word that's in there, or he's liable for them all? And I think the government would really love that to be the outcome, because, you know, WikiLeaks and everything, you know, mass sets of cables and Iraq and Afghanistan war logs and everything else. And, you know, the government, the authorities need to want to shut that down, lest they be faced with, you know, populist or people not falling for their propaganda any further.
Right.
And becoming disenchanted with the idea of, well, you know, just simply voting for these guys is going to bring at least a little mercy to the domination. We should continue begging them to be nicer, which won't.
All right. Now, in your tweet here, Douglas, you say that it appears that he will be hit with the full 8.5 years.
Yeah, that's, it looks like it.
That's just because of the judge's attitude while the prosecutor talked? Is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anything to say about the judge's body language while Barrett was reading his allocution there?
I won't go so far as to say glaring, but he looked at Barrett intently. I mean, like, more than concentration, though, just sort of like what is this guy saying? And I think that the judge did say stuff about how the picture the defense is trying to paint of Project PM and journalists as being Project PM being journalistic. The judge claimed that that's that the Brown was much more involved in trafficking stolen goods, etc., than the defense wants him to believe. So the judge is not happy with the defense or Brown's take on this explanation of this matter in his elocution.
Oh, man.
Regardless of whatever his facial expressions were, whether they were poker or what.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's the best answer there. The worst one, but the more substantive one.
Yeah. We're going back in early soon.
Yeah, I understand. You got to go. Well, thanks very much for your time, Douglas. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Okay, that's bye. Douglas Lucas, y'all, reporting from the Barrett Brown sentencing. We don't know yet. They're 30-minute recess, and then the bad news, sounds like. I'll keep my eye on the Twitter feed here for you. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Well, dang, man. I can't reach Trita. I get a busy signal when I try to reach Trita. But, anyways, that's all right. I'm going to try again in 10 minutes. I guess at the end he said there that the judge contradicted, Barrett and his lawyer about their interpretation of part of this thing. And seemed like he was annoyed. So, sounds bad. But I guess we'll see. Try to keep my, the Twitter feed open here. Anyway, as you may know, or you may have, understood from that conversation, this is a journalist who's being prosecuted for copying and pasting a link from a guy who had hacked. It was the H.B. Gary or the Stratfor hack. I forget. I think it was the Stratfor hack. Somebody posted the link to the results of the Stratfor hack, and then he copied and pasted that link into a chat room and said, hey, let's do some journalism on these documents. Huh? Okay, maybe if this was England and we had a queen and no Bill of Rights, but that's absolutely insane. And you know, the worst thing that he did was he used a very poor choice of words when threatening to dox an FBI agent, right? Like, I'm going to Google the hell out of you and post your credit score online where everybody can see it, that kind of thing, you know? But he used a very poor choice of words that the cops pretended to be afraid that he was actually threatening this cop and whatever, just at first. And that was why Barrett was at one point facing 100 years in prison. But all those charges were dropped because that was a bunch of crap. But what they're left with is they're prosecuting him for copying and pasting a link. For being a journalist and crowdsourcing journalism. And, you know, because they hate his guts. Because what he was interested in is the private, quote-unquote, contractor industrial complex that's grown up since September 11th. And particularly, you know, corporate espionage and homeland security stuff and all of the various little so-called companies, as though they're market operators, who violate our rights to collect government money. And their problem with him was he's good at it. And anyway, I guess we'll see what happens. They've been holding him, I guess. I don't know. Man, have I ever even asked any of these reporters? Did they set the bail at $1 million, or they set it at no bail? Like he's, you know, a dangerous predator who's going to kill again if they let him out. He's been sitting unconvicted. I guess he's, you know, was convicted a little while ago, pled a little while ago, but has been sitting in jail for, what, 3 years now or something? So his lawyers are pushing for time served, and I guess he's not going to get it. If you like reading good things, you should read what he writes at D-Mag, a magazine in Dallas. It's called Barrett Brown's Review of Arts and Letters in Jail. And it's brilliant stuff, man. How I know him is he was an unofficial, not spokesman, but journalist who understood and could talk about Anonymous. Back when Anonymous was a big deal in 2011 and all that. 2010 and 11 is when I interviewed him. You can read the transcripts or listen to the audio at scotthorton.org. And he talked about how Anonymous helped with coordinating the overthrow of Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak in Egypt at the dawn of the Arab Spring, back before America and Saudi Arabia hijacked it and waged their quite successful counter-revolution. Well, successful, depending on how you define it, of course, but yeah. So got a couple of decent interviews out of him. They're easier to read than hear because he was on a real bad phone both times, I think. But anyway, good guy, great journalist, and the feds are persecuting the hell out of him. It's happening right now in Dallas. Three new tweets on this feed here. Let me refresh. They're just going back to court right now. I don't know. Maybe we'll know by the end of the show. But good luck to you, Barrett. All right. Yeah, Treaty Parks is coming up. Oh, yeah. So I got a ton of news, man. Let me move on here to... I want to point you to this thing at the Future Freedom Foundation. It's by a guy named Philip Riboli. And it's called How the Pentagon Really Gets Funded. It's along the lines of what we talked about with Peter Van Buren there and all the money in the wars. But this is a review of Robert Gates's book. And he does a lot of complaining about the Pentagon bureaucracy in there, which is funny if you know the history of who Robert Gates is and all of that. But anyway, how the Pentagon really gets funded, and he's picking and choosing the most candid admissions about how America's system works here. And it's fascism. Hey, you could call it a soft, participatory-type fascism where you, too, can join the Democratic Party and then still live in a fascist state anyway and this kind of thing. It's not quite exactly like it was in Italy or Germany, but you look at the economics of it, and yeah, boy, it's a quasi-free market, to say the least there. This is how the Pentagon really gets funded. Read Philip Riboli at the Future Freedom Foundation. And then War on ISIS. Flood of jihadi volunteers to Syria is unstoppable, warns Turkish Prime Minister. Yeah, well, tried to tell you. I like this, too. Cooperation between British spies and Gaddafi's Libya revealed in official papers. Links between MI5 and Gaddafi's intelligence during Tony Blair's government more extensive than previously thought, according to the documents. And that's right, because they brought Gaddafi in from the cold in 2003 because they needed to pretend that the Iraq war had won them some form of victory anywhere. And so they were able to allow Gaddafi, who'd been begging on his knees for normalized relations since 1996, at least, according to Gary Hart in the New York Times Magazine. Former Senator Gary Hart said he met with Gaddafi's representatives in Athens in 96, and they begged him, please. And they've been begging ever since. And America supported the Mujahideen against him back in the 90s. Late 90s, or I guess the Brits were. Anyway. So in 2003, they let him back in from the cold so that they could pretend that the Iraq invasion scared him into it, and now he's going to be okay. When, as Eric Margulies points out, really all he did was buy a bunch of garage sale crap from AQ Khan, and his black market nuclear technology network, and it was all just sitting in boxes in warehouses. And Gaddafi only bought it so that he would have something to give the Americans as a PR stunt. And so they used it, and then they used him as a sock puppet to torture and murder their enemies for a few years there, until Hillary Clinton found him expendable in 2011, and they stabbed him in the back. He was better off America's enemy for 25 years. He becomes America's friend. He's dead in 8. And I do have that quote somewhere. It was in the chat room earlier. Someone quoted it. Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. Oh, man. I'm no good at pausing audio playing. I'm no good at cueing things.
We came, we saw, he died.
Yeah, that's a great Hillary Clinton for you on the backstabbing of Gaddafi there. And meanwhile, the civil war there continues to rage. And General Khalifa Haftar is America's man there now. Hey, at least they're backing the more secularist guy against the jihadis now, as though that's going to do us any good. Either way, you're making matters worse there. All right, see if I can get treated for you in a sec. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Oh, hell no, Trita. Busy Signal. I guess I could try to interview the Busy Signal, but it's probably not going to give me too good a context. Well, we'll just try again for tomorrow. That's all right. These things happen. All right. Yeah. Where was I? The ISIS war. Oh, let's talk about Yemen. Peter Van Buren brought up Yemen earlier on the show and how as an example of American foreign policy, that was absolutely horrible. First, they back the dictator there. Then they wage war on Al-Qaeda and destabilize the whole country. They pay him a bunch of money and guns that he uses to just go after his enemies, not fight our enemies, but fight his own, apparently making the Houthi rebellion stronger in response to his crackdown on their northern Shiite, formerly separatist, but now takeoverist revolutionary sect there. And in 2011, they helped transition Saleh out for, I thought it was his cousin. Van Buren said it was his son. Whatever. Anyway, it was a one-man election. Hillary Clinton praised the Yemeni democracy for working as intended. And then everything completely went to crap. The more America bombed Al-Qaeda, the stronger they got. Again, David Gregory says to Leon Panetta on Meet the Press back in, say, oh, could have been 2011 or 12. He said, hey, Leon Panetta, head of the CIA or Defense Department, whichever it is right now, we keep bombing Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and yet it appears that we keep making matters worse and worse and worse and making more and more enemies and accidentally killing, you know, our would-be allies and innocent civilians, and there's 10 new terrorists for every one we kill, so what the hell are we doing? And Leon Panetta said, hey, look, David Gregory, these are the tools we have. This is what we're going to keep doing, because this is what we're doing. And, hey, that was as good of an answer as you could have gotten out of him. So anyway, they made Al-Qaeda worse, and apparently the Houthis were mad enough at the regime, but decided they weren't going to take anything from these Al-Qaeda nuts, and so now they've conquered the capital city. And the reason that it seems to be a coup d'etat over and over again is because it's the same coup d'etat. It's just being reported by, or it's not even really a coup, it's a conquering from a northern sect. I don't know if that counts as a coup. Is that a coup de main? A coup des the Houthis from the north who came and kicked the government out. See, and here's what's funny. I was explaining this the other day. They kept the government. They kept all the civil servants on the payroll, you know, as they call them. They kept the government. They just took it over at the top. What was new the other day was that they had seized the palace for the first time, whereas before they had left it unseized, but their enemies had fled long ago. And anyway, everyone is saying, oh no, the Houthis have taken over the capital of Yemen. Well, that is, I guess, bad, all things being equal, just because it promises, you know, worse blowback and consequences and more people rallying to Al-Qaeda's side. Because after all, they are a small Shiite minority sect there, the Houthis. And, but Yemen is not even a state, man. I mean, there's all kinds of different factions all over the freaking place there. And the south and the north and the capital and the far east of the country are all very divided from each other anyway. And anyway, but the narrative is, oh no, some extremist group has taken over the capital or something. Oh, and I heard they're backed by Iran. And yet they don't want to say, at least not in those same articles or statements, that these are the guys who are fighting Al-Qaeda in Yemen. These are Al-Qaeda's enemies. And we're supposed to take the Saudi point of view, or is that the Israeli point of view? That, oh no, Iran likes the Houthis because they're Shia. I mean, I don't know if anyone's even showed me that a single dollar has ever traded hands there. Obviously, just the Iranians are rooting for the Houthis. I don't know if they've intervened any more than that. But even if they have, you know, I'm not for America backing Iran in Yemen any more than I'm for America backing Iran in Iraq. But if that's what they want to do, it would seem kind of strange for America to try to, the American establishment, to pretend that, like, they're the ones who are the problem when they're the ones fighting our enemies. You know, as evil and horrible as the Iraq policy is, it wasn't the Iranians or the Badr Brigade that attacked the United States. It was the Bin Ladenites, funded by the Saudis, that attacked the United States. And so as horrible and evil and counterproductive as it is to back the Shiites in this war, and as much as it should not be done, 10 times the same arguments for the other side. When these guys, contrary to popular belief, are the butchers of New York City, or at least those sworn loyal to them, third generation now. Well, jihadi generations go quickly. Here, strap this vest on and go blow yourself up, you idiot. What a way to wage war. But yeah, anyway, so there you go. I'm trying to arrange... Oh yeah, Greg Gordon, man, I forgot about him. Greg Gordon is the guy from McClatchy on Yemen. Didn't I speak with him before on the show one time? Yeah, man, I need to get him on. And I'm trying to get this guy Gregory Johnson on. He writes for the Daily Beast now. He got the Michael Hastings chair at BuzzFeed, not the Daily Beast, pardon me, BuzzFeed. I'm trying to get him on maybe for next week. Anyway, so now let me do a little bit of police state news for you before the show ends. First of all, Darren Wilson, the murderer cop in St. Louis there in Ferguson, will not face federal charges for killing Michael Brown. They do have, and I think they probably wanted to see if they could for the PR about it, but they got a very high bar on the civil rights thing, where they have to kind of argue the cop's state of mind and that he knew what he was doing was wrong and all of this kind of thing. In other words, just disprove that he was afraid at all, that kind of thing, which is a very high bar and very difficult to do. And that's part of the problem with Americans asking the federal government to hold their local and state officials responsible in the first place. That's why the black father of a boy who's been killed by a cop ought to be the district attorney in every city, in every county in America. But the problem is the American people suck and don't make it that way. I mean, all of you, not me, of course. I mean, everyone in America except you guys and me. They suck. And they make sure that people who love cops and will make sure that no law ever applies to a cop run their district attorney's offices for generations at a time and make sure that the status quo holds, which is that a simple deputy sheriff's badge is a license to kill, just like it used to be fiction. Well, how can the government give somebody a license to kill? They don't have the right to kill. Not any more than anyone else has the right to commit justifiable homicide in an immediate and proportionate act of defense. They don't have the right to kill. They can't license anyone to kill. Oh, sorry. That's USA, 20th century. This is the homeland now. Okay, it never really was a rule of law. It's sometimes fun to pretend that anyone ever... It used to be that people believed that the Constitution was the law. They weren't just completely over it as a society, you know, anyway. But anyway, so he's going to skate, and I'll remind you that there are 16 witnesses say that Michael Brown had his hands up. 16 witnesses. And the cop's story that it, this inhuman monster, black man, it turned into a demon, direct quotes, and bulked up to almost run through the bullets is an obvious stupid lie on its face, and it's only corroborated by a woman who the district attorney himself admits he knew she was lying entirely about even being there and witnessing anyone. Sean Hannity's star witness, witness number 40, who lied, who just weeks later, after reading in the paper Darren Wilson's account, wrote up an account of, oh yeah, I happened to be there, observing the N-words in the zoo that day, and here's what I saw. Yeah, right. 16 witnesses, and it only makes sense. And if you read the Vox story, I know Vox is stupid and horrible, but if you read the Vox story where they compare Darren Wilson's account to the account of Mike Brown's friend, they track perfectly step by step with what happened. And they're not sitting there listening to each other tell their story or anything. They're both telling their version of the same story, but it's Mike Brown's friend's story that makes sense, and it's Darren Wilson's story that doesn't make sense at all. It's 99% clear that he was still shooting at Mike Brown as he was fleeing, so Mike Brown turned to say, stop, don't shoot, I'm not armed. I don't have a gun, don't kill me. And then blam, 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 you're dead. And Darren Wilson, of course, he got away with it because he's a cop and he can murder anyone he wants.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.